Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Well, 5 years ago, the merger of Time Warner and America Online was heralded as a great fusion of old media with the new. Since then, the combined company has lost more than $200 million in value, and now there's growing pressure for that company to split back into two. AOL co-founder Steve Case expressed his doubts recently over notions of convergence and synergies that the $99 million merger promised, and the failure of the combined company may prove the point of my next guest. Douglas Rushkoff came to fame in the early 90s for his commentary on the viral media, so-called, that is, how ideas spread like viruses sometimes, and for pointing out that technology changes our response to old media models. Now Doug Rushkoff has a new book. He's had 10 bestsellers along the way. In this new one, he says one of the business world's biggest mistakes is trying to think outside the box, like AOL and Time Warner did at the start of this decade, and like we all seem to say to each other all the time without thinking whether it's really a good idea. His new book is called Get Back in the Box, Innovation from the Inside Out, out now from HarperCollins. Doug Rushkoff, welcome back to WNYC.
Hey, good to be with you.
You know, let's start with the AOL Time Warner deal. It's in the news, does come up in the book. When this merger was announced, our crack research staff has discovered that you were asked to write an op-ed for the New York Times that actually got spiked. It got canceled after you wrote it. Is that true?
Yeah, it is actually. It's funny because, you know, I was always a culture writer. You know, I've been writing about the internet as this great cultural phenomenon. And as things like Netscape and AOL and all that happened, people who used to have me write internet culture columns started to ask me to write internet as business columns. So the AOL Time Warner merger is announced, and I got my phone call from the New York Times op-ed, one of the editors there, saying, will you write our op-ed on that? And I'm like, yeah, sure. So I spend the day and write this op-ed where I basically say, this is the sign of the dot-com bubble bursting. And that Steve Case, the head of AOL, is actually cashing in his chips, his overvalued stock, in order to buy a real media company, Time Warner, and that it's bad for – ultimately really bad for Time Warner because now they're just taking on this tremendous amount of debt. They emailed back or called back and said, you know, well, we spoke to all the, you know, the various business editors here, and they say that that's a very fringe perspective and very negative. And why would you be so negative about such a great thing, you know, the convergence of two media companies? You know, they were kind of accusing me of being some kind of a closet Marxist or something. And I said, well, you know, actually, I think this is true. I'm an internet enthusiast, but I don't think just combining two companies for the sake of combining them is anything more than a way of adjusting stock prices and has nothing to do with any real synergy.
So your experience was they didn't really want the thoughts of Douglas Rushkoff, who had established a certain reputation as an independent thinker. They wanted a go-go Time Warner AOL because they had decided that that was the right position.
Right. Well, this was an era, you have to remember, when even guys like Louis Rukeyser, at the end of his show during the dot-com boom, was saying things like, keep the faith. I mean, what a bizarre way to end your business broadcast. So, yeah, it was a time when everyone was kind of rah-rah. Everybody was invested in one way or another, and anybody who was saying that maybe some of this enthusiasm and some of all this merger and acquisition activity might not be commonsensical.
So now the activist investor Carl Icahn is leading a drive to split the company back up, as we mentioned, one of the main forces being AOL Steve Case, arguing on Icahn's side. Can you put this genie back inside the box by splitting it up?
You'd stand a better chance by splitting it up than you would by trying to leave it together as one big conflicted mass. I mean, just as I think it's a great idea for public companies to take themselves private, I think it's a good idea for giant conglomerates to sometimes split themselves up into extremely competent separate companies rather than incompetent conglomerates with CEOs who can't possibly have a real feel for all of the businesses he's supposed to be invested in.
Is that at the heart of the think back inside the box notion?
Yeah. I mean, really what I'm looking at is sort of the what I think is the 400-year process by which we've kind of alienated ourselves from what it is we do, you know, and we've created a business culture of professional and interchangeable managers, you know, where the CEO of the Gap can proudly say on his first day of work that he's never worked in the apparel business. That's, for my money, it's showing some contempt for the industry he's actually in. What we need to do is to look at our business processes less as balance sheet phenomena and more as whether or not they're connected to the core values and core competencies of the businesses we're actually in. And that's considered a radical view, but it's really, it's so common sense as to be silly. But if your phone rang the way my phone rings from, you know, with CEOs and senior vice presidents asking to be taken outside of the box and to have new ideas about how to do what they do, and I ask them, well, do you understand the business you're actually in? And they'll say, well, no, but. It's like, well, then you've got a problem to start with.
So I'm curious if you think this relates back to AOL Time Warner in terms of the quality of the content that either produces. Did the magazines that Time Warner was already well known for or its cable channels suffer, in your opinion? Did AOL, which seems to me has continued to become even more of an online empire, suffer as a result of the merger?
Well, can we speak freely? I think that when a magazine, say like Time, is no longer just in service of the news, but is now in service of a corporate conglomerate, when you've got the workers at Time Warner who are being given, you know, AOL Time Warner stock and keep a little icon of the stock price on their screen, you know, fluctuating over the day as they work, they can't help but have their articles and editorial bias slant towards what's going to make that number for their kids' college and the food on their table, what's going to make that number go up. So we did see Time Magazine become much more, almost libertarian in its philosophy. We found the other brands of Time Warner magazines becoming much more kind of corporate-driven, celebrity-driven, balance sheet-driven. We saw less print on the pages. I mean, we also saw a lot of people leave those magazines, really disgusted that they were no longer responsible for their own editorial content. It all seemed to, the decision seemed to come from the top, and then everything from their, you know, water coolers to their Coca-Cola was taken away from them.
My guest is technology and society thinker and writer Douglas Rushkoff. His new book, Get Back in the Box, Innovation from the Inside Out. We can take phone calls for him at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Any comments, listeners, on how culture is shifting, how you're adapting to the new way of consuming culture, new various ways? Are you a parent who buys electronic learning tools for your kids? These are all things that Douglas Rushkoff can comment on. If you're in business, if you want to talk about the idea of core competencies and when expansion and synergy with other kinds of services or companies is good and when it's destructive, 212-433-9692. And Doug, in the book, you contrast two companies to illustrate the concept, Saatchi & Saatchi and Craigslist. And you said Saatchi went wrong because it focused on growth, while Craigslist succeeded because it stuck to what it knows best. Why do you think Craigslist is the better model?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, if you look at the real history of Saatchi & Saatchi, I mean, it was these, you know, two brothers who started an advertising agency, and it was successful as an advertising agency. But then what they decided to do was to become an advertising conglomerate. They kind of used some loopholes in investment law in the UK to become a holding company, and they started buying up all these advertising agencies. Well, it turns out the Saatchi brothers were much better at running an advertising agency than running an advertising conglomerate, which is a completely different job. And they ended up over the course of a decade or so driving a giant business into the ground and leaving, you know, Saatchi & Saatchi sort of in name alone, this little brand name that got sold off and is this, it's a sad little shadow, sort of boutique of its former self. And it's still based in fluff and ideas and ways of branding itself rather than ways of branding its clients.
You actually say something similar about Enron in the book, don't you?
Well, yeah. I mean, what were they? What were they? You know, finally, they were not an energy company, but a way of sort of trading energy futures. They were a finance company. And no, it wasn't their core enterprise. It wasn't their core expertise. And in the end, it went against, you know, the values of the original company in theory, which was to provide energy to people. You know, they ended up really making more money by keeping energy scarce than they would by providing it. So they were at cross purposes with themselves. Then you compare that with a company like Craigslist. I mean, Craig started doing his service, which was really just a newsletter of kind of classified ads for his friends in San Francisco. He started doing that way before the dot-com boom. And he did the same old thing right through the dot-com boom. He was offered money here and offered money there to become a dot-com. And he was like, no, I like what I'm doing and I like the way I'm doing it. And I'm concerned I won't be able to do it quite as well if I get distracted by, you know, investors or angels or whatever it's called and venture capital. And, you know, now he's making easily, you know, $10 million a year, which I know is nothing compared to a giant media conglomerate, but it's a lot compared to the 99% of dot-coms that actually failed over the years.
I know you had a big thread of conversation on your website recently about Ben and Jerry's along this line. We'll get to that, but let's take a phone call right
Please.
Now. Harvey in Livingston. You're on WNYC with Douglas Rushkoff. Hi, Harvey.
Good morning. I do not disagree with Mr. Rushkoff, but I'd like him to comment on my feeling that it is sometimes helpful to bring somebody who doesn't know anything about the field but has had success in other areas to examine your methods and to examine your procedures. Doesn't that give you a fresh perspective with respect to running a company?
Absolutely. And if, you know, if you're in a business and you've got people who are truly committed, nose to the grindstone, and focused on doing the thing they do, making pens, making shoes, you know, doing a computer service. If you've got people who are actually really focused on what they're doing, then no doubt it could be a terrific idea to bring in an outside consultant who can help you see some things that were successful in other businesses and then apply it to what you're doing. Unfortunately, what more often the case is you've got a bunch of people from really middle management on up who have no idea what their core competency is, who have no idea how to do the thing that their company supposedly does, and the consultant they bring in is an expert in the thing that they're supposed to be the expert in. So they ended up having it reversed.
Maybe the ultimate argument against what you just said is Mayor Bloomberg, coming from business and his success by most people's lights at running city government.
Well, city government is for the most part business. I mean, it's budget. It's really managing money and managing a budget.
So much more. It's public safety. It's education. It's all these things.
It is, but all those things cost money. And I mean, from the time since I was a kid onward, all I knew was which mayors we had that bankrupted the city and which ones defaulted and which ones didn't. So on a certain level, he is about competency, about finding people that, you know, by hook or by crook, are basically competent in the area that he's trying to make them in charge of. In some cases, he's using people that seem like outsiders, like with education. It was an interesting counterexample. I mean, we can still argue whether or not he's been good for it or not, but he's definitely an outsider to education.
We'll continue in a minute with Douglas Rushkoff. His new book, Get Back in the Box, Innovation from the Inside Out, Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with technology and society writer Douglas Rushkoff. 10 best-selling books, and his new one, Get Back in the Box, Innovation from the Inside Out. And Kevin in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC.
Good morning.
Hi.
Isn't the purpose of the Time Warner merger to provide Time Warner with a porthole onto the internet, which they were sorely lacking and able to get started on their own so that they could deliver their content, whether it's CNN News, whether it's movies, whether it's old television shows, onto the internet? And isn't the jury still out on whether this could work? I mean, the technology is not yet there to deliver the movies instantly on AOL, but that it's got to come soon. So maybe it's too early to tell whether this thing is going to work.
Well, the irony here is that Time Warner had and still has better internet delivery than AOL. You know, Time Warner has, although I think they're spinning off Roadrunner, but Time Warner actually had the cable infrastructure. The other thing I had written in that op-ed back then, which was sort of the real dark, dirty secret, was that AOL was buying Time Warner for its cable. All AOL really had was a whole bunch of subscribers to a dial-up system. They didn't have access to the cable, to the coaxial cable that Time Warner had throughout the country. So the AOL was really buying Time Warner to have a portal for its content and not the other way around.
But AOL has more than that. AOL, for example, all the kids today, I have two teenagers, they IM all day long on AOL to their friends. Those kids could download movies if they wanted to see them. Suppose they want to see King Kong. Once the technology is there, they could punch in King Kong and they could buy it for, say,
yeah, but they're going to be buying a Time Warner property and downloading it through Time Warner Cable. I mean, and they're going to use an AOL face on their browser, which is basically, or on their IM, which is something that they bought from someone else. So AOL, yes, as the holding company, because people invested in it, had money to purchase the various companies that were actually going to offer these things.
Kevin, thanks for your call. And along these lines, you also talk in the book about creative programming often being advertising in disguise. You say that about Queer Eye for the Straight Guy.
Well, yeah, I mean, and that's not even in disguise. I mean, you know, most reality programming is a way of integrating advertising into a program directly. So it doesn't have to be, you know, the people on Friends or you know, using a Starbucks. It can be, you know, Donald Trump having everyone try to come up with a Starbucks ad. I mean, it can be really that direct.
And we're going to do a segment next week, by the way, on the Writers Guild protesting having to write all these products into scripts for TV shows. But I guess this goes to,
as opposed to just writing the background music for it, you know, in a sense.
Let me read an excerpt from the book that, as of a few days ago, you've been highlighting on your website that goes into the very nature of products in America today and what they mean in our lives. You wrote, however much attention goes into their design, products from Apple computers to Fluvog shoes are less valuable to customers as objects than they are as enablers of experience. They are a form of social currency, making connections between people not just technologically, but also philosophically. Boy, that's not what most people think when they go out and buy a pair of shoes.
Maybe it's not what most people are thinking who are buying a pair of shoes for the comfort and fit of the shoe. You know, when a kid's buying a pair of Nikes versus Adidas versus Reebok versus Simple versus Converse, there's a very different discussion going on in his head. And that's really how am I gonna represent myself, or what tribe or what club do I want to belong to?
So when you say form of social currency, does that just mean status?
In a way, but ideally it really means how can I connect with another person. I used to always talk about the difference between sort of the baseball cards and bubble gum. You know, when my dad was a kid, he'd buy a pack of bubble gum and there'd be one baseball card inside. When I was a kid, there'd be 10 baseball cards and one stick of bubble gum. And now you buy baseball cards and there's no bubble gum at all. And I would argue that's because baseball cards actually serve as better social currency than a stick of gum. A stick of gum you can share once and it's done. A baseball card really is an enabler of a conversation. You can flip cards, you can play games, you can trade, you can have conversations about the stats on it. But when I buy something, and most of the people I've talked to and studied, we buy things not because we want to take them home and be with them alone. We buy things because we want an excuse for someone else to come over and play with that thing with us or see that thing. So if we start to understand products and consumer goods less sort of as ends in themselves and rather as means or even media in themselves, then it's less about advertising the product and more about thinking of the product itself as a medium.
And you even break down the distinction between the product and the consumer, because you write that when the internet emerged, people became the content.
Well, right. And that was the thing that got everyone so upset, or at least got business so upset, was that people were satisfied going online and interacting with one another. And what do you do in a world where people are happy socializing with one another?
Oh my
God. What can we sell them?
Yeah, how do we charge for that?
Right. We can't charge for that. And worse, you know, they'd found by 1994, the average family that had an internet connection in their home was watching 9 hours less sponsored television a day. You know, so this is a real nightmare for people who do their business or think their business depends on keeping people apart, on separating people rather than bringing them together.
Technology and society writer Doug Rushkoff, author of Get Back in the Box, Innovation from the Inside Out, my guest on WNYC. Our phone number, 212-433-WNYC, and Elsie in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Good morning. I just wanted to confirm your guest's comments from earlier about how the merger of AOL and Time Warner did not benefit the employees. I watched in the course of 6.5 years our benefits whittle down, the product watered down, all in an effort to try and make this merger successful. And
yeah.
It was not successful at all. No one that I knew thought so. I certainly didn't think so.
And when it's funny, the common thread, really, in the book and in the conversations we're having is, if you run a business in a smart way with competent people, then your job in management and running a business is really to have an integrated business, is to figure out what is the one thing we're doing and how, by dedicating everyone to that one thing, can we do the best job possible.
Right.
That's how you'll make your money in the long run. So if the one thing we're doing is making magazines, then who do you turn to make the best magazines? Your editors, your writers, because these are the people who care. When AOL Time Warner's magazine division was starting to crash and burn and everyone was jumping ship, the people who were the most upset about it really were the writers. And that was the funny. I mean, I'm a writer too, so I guess I identify with them. But were people who said, you know, gosh, I loved working at Blank Magazine and this magazine. We were so good. We had the best this and the best that. And now it breaks my heart that not only are our benefits and everything else cut, not only are we being treated like employees instead of being treated like members of this magazine community, but the quality of our work. I mean, when I started to talk to writers who were embarrassed to have their name on their articles because of the way they were being watered down, that's how I knew it was really over.
Yeah, and there has been a talent drain at Time Warner steadily. There's always been a problem keeping really good talent, but there has been a very steady, marked talent drain.
And you think
the merger.
Because of the merger. Elsie, thank you for your call.
Thank you.
Let me ask you something about yourself, Doug Rushkoff. You've been a media commentator for over a decade now. You've been on this show many times. And more recently, you've become a regular speaker on the corporate lecture circuit. Would you say this that you're doing now is more of a philosophy for business, a profit strategy for business, or a comment on culture? And can you be concerned with the culture and be consulting corporations at the same time?
Well, yeah, certainly. I mean, I think if you are concerned about culture, you have to talk to corporations because, well, first, corporations don't exist. You have to talk to the people who are in corporations and convince them that they can take charge of the entities that currently are running their lives and running a lot of our lives. You've got to go where power is. I mean, and essentially, I've been saying the same thing in the last 10 books I've written, and that is that the world we live in is still programmable. It's still designable. It's not completely out of our control. I mean, whether you talk to an open source programmer, or whether you just talk to a good, smart engineer, or whether you just talk to someone who's basically literate, the thing that we have to teach ourselves as a society, and we might as well teach our CEOs this, is that they can still be in charge of what their companies do. Although it may seem that the cart's in front of the horse, and in many cases it is, it's not so far out of control that we need to abandon our common sense and our agency.
You also write that your friends can't understand why you don't hate corporations. What are those conversations like?
Well, they're like, oh, so you're going and doing a speech at Microsoft. Maybe they'll actually will. I haven't. But you're doing a speech for these guys. You're doing a speech for those guys. How dare you do that? You know, aren't you one of us lefty, you know, Marxist kind of people? And
oh, they don't say lefty Marxist.
Well, that's what they mean. Are you a sellout now? No, you know, the only way a person can be a sellout is if they're saying something they don't believe in. When you're a sellout is when you've literally changed your message and changed what your heart wants to express because you're going to get more money doing that than doing something else. If I'm invited to Starbucks or Pepsi or Coke or anywhere to address the people in that place and tell them that it's not too late and they can work in a way consistent with what they believe, I'm going to go do it. And if they pay me and pay for my, you know, baby's food and diapers, so much the better.
Dale in Jersey City, you're on WNYC. Hi, Dale.
Hi, good morning, Brian. Love your show.
Thanks.
Doug, I'd like to know what your view is on a company like Murdoch buying a peer-to-peer group such as MySpace, where the social currency, of course, is being used as a way of conveying ads.
I mean, it's smart on the one hand, but I wonder if it's doomed on the other. In other words, will the embrace of the behemoth squash the life that's there? You know, and will the people who are dedicated to that community run? If they just buy the thing and keep hands off it completely, I mean, that there's no visible change, then, I suppose things will sail on. But I can't imagine a company like News Corp won't look at this community and think, how do we tap the energy from it? Mm. You know, the same way when the big record labels came into rock and roll and said, okay. I mean, it took them 20 years, you know, in the rock and roll's case, and I think now it'll probably take more like two.
But aren't there counterexamples like Google, which is still so wildly successful, even though it's spreading out all over the place into maps and
books
and phones?
Yeah, but Google's very different. Google is something that started tiny and grew more like kudzu vines, as opposed to a real community that ends up just getting purchased by one of the conglomerates. You know, if 8 years ago, say, Google had just been bought by News Corp, I think we'd be looking at a very different Google today.
In today's Times, on the front page, there's a piece about parents spending hundreds of dollars on electronic educational tools for their babies, like computers designed for toddlers. And the Kaiser Family Foundation criticized this kind of approach in the article, since their studies show it doesn't affect kids' education, ultimately. As such a cyber thinker, I wonder if you had an opinion about that.
Most of the things parents...
And by the way, as a new parent of how old now, child?
Oh, she's going to be a year on next Thursday, on the 22nd.
Congratulations.
Thank
you. Is she wired yet?
No, although she likes TV. She does. I mean, and that's supposed to be against the rules, right? No screen time until 2 years old, officially.
What do you feed her? Teletubbies?
I love Ann Wood, actually. She's a friend of mine. But no, she's watching Boobah, which is the follow-up to Teletubbies.
I forgot. That's after Teletubbies, for the one-year-old market, they decided there was a niche that wasn't being served.
Exactly. She likes Boobah and she likes Oswald, but they took Oswald off the air, so now we're with DVDs of Oswald.
So have you thought about how early you would introduce computers?
Well, she likes our computers. We leave them off usually, so she doesn't erase everything, but she loves the keys. I think that... there's a lot for kids to learn before computers. Computers are a very the easiest way to say it is it's a weightless space. You know, the laws of gravity don't affect you online. And I think that for a kid growing up, really, until they've mastered some of the basic physical stuff, I think that they're going to be more naturally fascinated by things like balls going up in the air and dropping. I think they'll be more interested in a pinball machine on a certain level than they will a video game, because it's dealing with something physical, and they don't understand the laws of nature are still miraculous to them. They don't need the fake ones yet.
Have you seen Bubble Trouble?
No, I haven't.
Balls going up in the air and dropping competitively online. Harry in Howell, you're on WNYC. There's a tongue twister. Harry and Howell, you're on WNYC with Douglas Rushkoff, author of Get Back in the Box, Innovation from the Inside Out. Hi, Harry.
Hi, good morning, and thank you. I wanted to call because I haven't read the book. I loved very much one particular comment about the fact that manager is a manager, whether he does widgets or space flight. They are not interchangeable. But the reason I'm calling is this. The expression itself, round square peg in a round hole, vice versa, has become so generic that people use it, and there are instances where thinking outside of the box is the only solution to a very complex problem. I'm an engineer by training. I've had instances where this is the way grandfather did it, this is the way great-grandfather did it. Do it the same way. Why must you be different?
Yes. So in order to promote quality, do you need to disparage, Doug, the idea of thinking outside the box, which has come to mean thinking creatively and not thinking stagnantly?
I think it's fine, ultimately, to think outside the box if you know how to think inside the box. If you really understand what you're doing, it's great to be able to get momentary perspective on it and then go back in and work on it. The problem is most companies now are using thinking outside the box as an excuse for never attaining any competence at all, and as a kind of a one-size-fits-all marketing solution for what are ultimately production problems. You know, the calls that I get when they say, "Go, will you come and help us think outside the box? Will you come and give us the mile high view?" And I'll ask them some very basic questions. Say, "Well, have you thought about how you're manufacturing your product?" And say, "Well, actually, we outsource that to China." "Well, then have you thought about the design of your product?" "Well, actually, we outsource that to New Jersey." "Well, what do you do?" And then they basically do the finance and they do the market and the package. And that's the kind of outside-the-box thinking I'm concerned about.
Harry, thanks for calling. We're almost out of time. What was the problem you have with Ben and Jerry's?
Well, it's funny. It got everyone so upset. What I was interested in, and the more I talk about trying to integrate your business, think about the one thing you're doing and really do it and really care about it. And it should be something that you actually do care about and do value. If you do that, if you really address a human need as well as you can, then the idea of sort of giving money to charity to compensate for what your company does on the other hand stops making sense. So in other words, rather than being like an Altria or Philip Morris or something, say you make cigarettes with one hand, but then you give a bunch of money to museums on the other hand, if you actually do something that helps people, if you're doing a Craigslist, for example, or a meetup.com or a lot of these companies that actually serve human needs, then the enterprise itself is the great thing. And one of the examples I brought up was a company that's thought of as sort of the golden child of altruistic companies is Ben and Jerry's. And what made them still seem like an out-of-the-box company to me, rather than a kind of integrated core competency company, is here they are. They say, "We invented this company in order to do good for the world." And while they give a whole bunch of money to great causes and they use rainforest, whatever.
And we have 15 seconds.
They're making ice cream for an obese and diabetic nation. So are they getting up in the morning doing something that's actually good for people or not?
Ben Cohen on this show said, "I don't recommend that people eat our ice cream 3 meals a day, only 2.
And there you have it. I mean, he knows that the actual thing he's doing is not what he's thinking he's doing.
Doug Rushkoff's new book, Get Back in the Box, Innovation from the Inside Out, published by HarperCollins. Thought-provoking and stimulating as usual. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll take your calls. Whose side are you on in the transit dispute? Call us up, 212-433-WNYC.